Hi everyone, I'm Chris Aldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Raymond C. Pierce and Megan Crow. Mr. Pierce serves as the President and CEO of the Southern Education Foundation, and prior to that, he was Dean of the School of Law at North Carolina Central University and served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights in the administration of President Bill Clinton. He began his career as a civil rights attorney in Little Rock, Arkansas, with the John W. Walker Law Firm. Megan Crow is the Senior Research and Policy Analyst for the Southern Education Foundation, and she has also served as a Policy Analyst for the Southern Regional Education Board and conducted commissioned research for the Center for State and Local Finance. Megan's research has focused on state education progress, dual enrollment, post-secondary transitions, adult education, and the impacts of automation and the COVID-19 pandemic on workforce participation and economic opportunity. Both are with us today to talk about the Southern Education Foundation's new report entitled Economic Vitality and Education in the South, Part 1, The South's Pre-Pandemic Position. Thank you both for being on this month's podcast. Raymond, let me start by asking you about the Southern Education Foundation. So for listeners who may not be familiar, what is the foundation's mission?
Chris, the Southern Education Foundation's mission is one that's been in existence well over 150 years, and that mission is to advance education opportunity and equity, primarily for African Americans and people of color and low-income persons in the South. Our origins date back to the days following the Civil War, and quite frankly, even a little bit before the Civil War ended, when George P. Biddy considered the father of modern-day philanthropy, and at that time, one of the wealthiest men in the nation, just felt that the United States was getting behind economically and that the Europeans were embracing the Industrial Revolution, whereas the United States was still wedded to that agrarian economy. And not only that, half the labor was enslaved in a barbaric system, and people like George Peabody were arguing that we need to end this slavery and get these folks educated so that we could fully embrace this Industrial Revolution is coming and join that new economy. So when the war ended and the government was moving slow during the Reconstruction period, it was philanthropists like George Peabody. And in fact, George Peabody put up $1 million in 1867 to create the Peabody Fund to buy books and train teachers and build schools for this new population of people in the South, this emancipated population, people coming right out of slavery. A few years after that, John Slater, a very wealthy gentleman out of Connecticut, did the same thing, put up $1 million, which is a lot of money back then, actually hired a former president, Rutherford B. Hayes, to run the foundation to do the same thing as Peabody was, to get this population of people in the South educated by buying books and training teachers and building schools. And then late 1800s, Anna Jeans, considered one of the wealthiest women in the nation, a Quaker woman actually out of Philadelphia, put up $1 million to create the Jeans Fund, which focused on teachers. So her goal was to create an army of teachers, mostly African-American women teachers in the South, to provide education. So eventually all these foundations, including another foundation, were consolidated to form in 1934 to form what is now the Southern Education Foundation. And we continue that mission. We're not building schools and buying books and training teachers, but we are developing education leaders, particularly superintendents and principals. We continue our research work to guide our policy recommendation, and we continue our advocacy work. So we've got a long history. We've done quite a bit over our 154-year history, Chris, and we're proud to still be at it.
So obviously we know that there's a historical, sociopolitical, economic context in the South that's created the environment in which schools operate. How would you say your findings speak directly to that context?
The findings speak directly to that context, and that if you go through the report, we actually do address some of the history of where some of these things came from. So we do look at historic workplace policies that allowed employers to continue discriminating based on race or based on gender. We look at some of the historic workplace policies that provided protections in industries that were predominantly worked by white men. But were, you know, reserved from protecting other industries in which Black and brown people predominantly worked. We look at some of the history behind how the criminal justice system is where it is today. One in every 81 Black people in America is serving prison time. They are over-incarcerated at rates far beyond those of white and even beyond rates that we see in other developed nations. So we look at the history of some of that. As well, you know, we look into the fact that, you know, poverty is generational. A parent, let's say, who has a high school attainment level of or has a high school educational attainment level, their children are 10 times as likely to have that same level of achievement in their lives. And we know that frequently, it's not a perfect relationship, but frequently a lower educational attainment level means that you have reduced job security, you're more likely to be in poverty, you're going to earn a lower wage for your entire life. And so whatever is true in the parent's life then in a lot of respects becomes true in the child's life. And these are generational issues.
So Megan, let me ask you about the specific findings and the data that you were able to use to conduct your analysis. You mentioned throughout the report that there were some limitations in the data that you were able to access, some limitations in the measures that are used. How did those limitations, for example, on how poverty is measured or what data is provided by prisons, how did that change your analysis and how did that change your interpretations of the findings?
I'd say first, I felt it was very important within the report to highlight and address some of those issues. Frequently in research, we don't maybe take the time or, you know, have the space to go into the level of depth about what our data is actually able to tell us and what it is not. So it was really important for me to call out, you know, what we're really looking at. Statistics is, you know, not a thing that everybody deals with every day. So making sure that we're being very clear about what all that says. So first and foremost, I felt it was really important to be very clear about what we were saying, because we are making some large proclamations, if you will, and then offering, you know, a series of suggestions based on those findings. So one of the main challenges when looking at all of this data is just whether or not it's available at all. So the first issue is just availability. You know, states do not all collect the same data. They don't collect it the same, in the same ways. You know, things that qualify to be whatever the data name is in one state might differ very much from another. So then the next issue becomes comparability. I had to elevate to the level of a lot of public data sources that have less details because they're able to gather multiple states together. So at least we have some comparability. Whereas if you go to the individual states for even the same data, you might see different numbers by state. So you also then run into the issue of, you know, the public data source, even within the same year, doesn't say the exact same thing that an individual state might collect. And that's, you know, based on data reporting. And so what that led me to do then is just stick with those publicly available data sources that they were all comparable. So at least I wasn't then having to run into issues of definitions and things on a state level. I would say because this is done at that higher level, it didn't necessarily change the analysis so much, but it did become very important just to highlight, you know, like you talked about poverty. So free and reduced price lunch eligibility is one common form of poverty status or low income status that researchers like to use. And that's because we don't collect good data in other ways that provide that same type of statistic. Another big thing that is lacking from the data is race and demographic information. So you will see several places. One of them deals with student discipline, where we point out that the data samples, while they are collecting some demographic information, they do not do a whole and complete job of doing that. That's also very present in the criminal justice data that is available, that they don't take good time to measure. And so what that means for us is oftentimes the inequities are probably worse than what we can observe. And also because we can't observe specific issues or we don't know how many people are being affected, that also changes then what our recommendations can be. What we know is that recommendations obviously vary from federal to state to local, but they're also going to vary widely based on if you're going in two different states or even if you're going within two different districts in the same state. And so being able to tailor recommendations and provide good ones that can be used at different levels by multiple different constituents becomes difficult when the data is lacking.
So what is the social determinants of education framework, and why is this framework helpful for thinking about the relationship between student opportunity and student achievement? For example, often the emphasis is on academic test scores and academic achievement and ranking school districts or schools that way. How does the social determinants framework help us change the discourse around schools and success and what students need to succeed?
The social determinants of education framework is kind of similar to that social determinants of health. So we know in the health industry that 30 to 50% of a person's health outcomes can be attributed to things other than their medical care. The same is true in education. So a large percentage of a child's educational outcomes can be attributed to things outside of what happens in the classroom, or even to some things that do happen in the classroom, like student to teacher ratio. So how many of their kids there are per teacher, as an example. But what this framework is really trying to achieve is starting to point out that there are myriad policy recommendations that we could implement that would change how children show up to schools in the first place. So a social determinants of education framework really is trying to grasp and explore the relationship between all of the various factors and variables that affect a child's ability to learn, and then the resources and the teacher and the school and the materials that are available to them in the classroom. We really want to have a call to action for states to understand poverty, for example, is one of the most reliable indicators that we have of whether or not a child is going to do well in school. We cannot address all of the inequities that a child faces who's living in poverty while they're in the classroom. A teacher cannot make up for whether or not a child is living in a stable home, whether or not that child their parent has access to a stable job or a livable wage. That teacher cannot address whether or not the child gets three meals a day or whether or not, you know, they only get the one that's in school. And so a social determinants of education framework is another way of framing research, of framing policy design, of measuring the success or lack thereof of various policy implementation. And it's trying to help understand how all of these different systems are playing into a child's ability to learn and succeed in school. And then therefore to have a more successful future and be set up in their adulthood to provide the same types of resources to their children.
If I might add, this is not a new tactic, so to say, of the Southern Education Foundation. But unfortunately, since schools seem to be the scapegoat for all that is wrong, particularly among certain populations in the country, we have to, again, step back and take a look at all the determining factors, as Megan calls them, social determinants. And this is what was done during the early days of the development of public education in the South, what eventually became public education in the South. Unlike the North, where public education was a movement from Horace Mann to went directly to legislators, you know, to get money to pay for, you know, books and schools and teachers. In the South, the development of public education, which is totally separate from the way it was developed in the North, was in the aftermath of a war. And not only was it in the aftermath of a war, but the principal population, the mass education effort, was focused on a population of people who had heretofore been enslaved. And therefore, social factors are assigned to this population. So you had to deal with the condition of the family when we were setting up schools in the South in 1870 and 1878. You had to deal with the food, you know, do the children have food to eat? Some of that was actually coming to school. You had to deal with the development of teachers because you didn't have teachers. You had to deal with the economics of the situation. How much time can we get these students in the classroom given the fact that many of them are going to be outside working in these fields? And so, you know, looking at all these social determinants, all these variables that go into, you know, mass education or the most effective way to educate people in large numbers is, again, nothing new for us. It's just that from time to time, we have to update, the information. As Megan's done an outstanding job in doing that, updating the information. Be more articulate on the determining or variables, and then offering some sound policies, suggestions that could, if implemented, could hopefully address these inequities.
So let me ask you about findings. Are there any specific findings in the report that you'd like to highlight?
The most important finding from the Eaves report, I think, really is just this social determinants of education framework as a concept. You know, the report didn't really find anything unique. Obviously, we used a lot of 2019 pre-pandemic data, so a lot of this is old. But what's important about it is that it's historic, that it's ongoing, and that in a lot of cases, the things that we have been talking about for years are getting worse and were worsened significantly by the pandemic. You know, a lot of people feel like there are so many things going on. How can we possibly address all of these issues? But I think the pandemic really has given us an opportunity to ask, can we afford to continue waiting? I think the most, you know, one of the most valuable things in this report is that it did a good job of bringing together in a more comprehensive light all of these various factors that affect children. When you asked about the data, I also want to be very clear that we have a tendency to assume causal relationships that are incorrect. So for example, we see student disciplinary actions and Black children are being disciplined at much higher rates than would be expected based on their enrollment numbers, but also at much higher rates than white children. And oftentimes from that data, what we determine is that Black children misbehave more, and that's why they are penalized more. But that is actually not true. When you dig into the data and you find out that student resource officers are more frequently placed in schools where there are Black children, and the only significant difference that they found is that there are significantly increased rates of disorderly conduct charges, but no other charges related to arrest rates or drugs or anything else like that. What that tells us is that Black children weren't committing more infractions. It's just that those infractions were being deemed illegal because there's a police officer in their schools more often. And that's a really important thing that we need to remember, that this simple data and, you know, when we're attaching race to academic outcomes, we like to think that the academic outcomes is related to that child based on their race, and it just is not true. And this report really brings together a lot of the inequities that continue to disproportionately affect Black and Brown children in America and say, no, of course they're not going to achieve at the same rates. They don't have the same opportunity. They don't have the same housing. They don't have the same teachers. They don't have the same anything. They're dealing with significant disproportionality in almost every aspect of their lives. And so this report is really trying to, you know, hit home to people. And we also address, you know, just the racism that is and sometimes baked into the actual assessments that students are taking that we're assuming say how good they do or not. Tests are designed and test questions are chosen for who answers them correctly most often. And the questions that are not answered correctly by most of the students, i.e. by the Black and Brown children, are thrown out. There are cultural reasons that people might choose one answer over another on a test. It has absolutely nothing to do with their academic performance. So this report is really trying to call out that there is not a direct cause relationship here. It's not as simple as we would like it to be. And if we really want to get some new outcomes, we have got to start addressing all of these other policy areas. And not only should we just be concerned, you know, just in the test outcomes and these things, but it's like we're talking about the greater economy for our country. Like the South lags the nation overall in various metrics of health, of education, of poverty, incarceration, mortality rates, all kinds of things. But the nation lags other developed nations as well. And so this report is really also just trying to say we all benefit from diversity. We all benefit from having a well-educated public. We all benefit when Black and Brown children do well. We all benefit together. But the cost of not working together, the cost of continuing to just do the least with social welfare programs and continuously declining education budgets is not going to get us where we want to be as a nation. It is not going to yield a thriving economy that is competitive on the global marketplace. The time is now to do something about all of these historic inequities that were just, you know, really brought to the forefront of our attention during the pandemic.
Let me ask you about recommendations and implications. And it seems like there are specific recommendations that can come from the report, what you would say next steps should be. And then there are implications, which Raymond, you've already started to describe some of them, and Megan, you as well, right? This isn't just about students' lives. This is about the lives of teachers. This is about the lives of families. This is about the lives of entire communities and their success. So what would you say are the specific recommendations of the report? And then what would you say are the implications of the report for how we think about education policy more broadly?
I think the first main recommendation in the Economic Vitality in Education in the South report is really to start approaching education policy and research with this social determinants in mind. So I think that that is first and foremost, this call to action for, you know, district, state, and federal leaders alike to all really start understanding that we are asking educators and the education system to do way too much with way too little. I think the second big suggestion is to start addressing all of these inequities in ways other than, you know, trying to do the least by treating kids once they're already in school. We need to do more for kids before they ever end up in the classroom. Beyond that, the report does include at the end of it a series of recommendations that address each one of these areas that are discussed in the report. So we furnished a group of recommendations. Many of them are federal, some of them are state level, but there are even, you know, district level considerations in here. And even within schools, we have some recommendations for school administrators. So the answers are not going to be the same everywhere. What works in one state is not necessarily going to work in another, or districts, as I've already stated. I think one of the biggest things that we could do is, you know, start addressing poverty. Like I said, as that is one of the most reliable indicators for educational outcomes, that would probably be a good place to start. But then we also have to understand all of the various things that influence whether or not a family is in poverty. So I think one of the biggest recommendations that comes out of that is do more than one thing. You know, take more than one of the suggestions. Try to treat poverty while you're trying to treat homelessness, while you're trying to treat, you know, disproportionate disciplinary actions. As well, I think we need to get businesses involved. There is some call in the report to bring in business and industry leaders because they too have some power to affect change in the workplace. And we have ongoing legislated and informal discrimination that takes place in the workforce. So, for example, you know, a person might not be trying to do anything wrong, but let's say that I'm in a management position and I go to promote another person, I'm more likely to promote someone who looks and thinks and talks like me. You know, and that doesn't mean that I did anything wrong. It's just that is normal human nature. So, I mean, there's even some things that we need to just look at in ourselves to address. But I think the main suggestion that comes out of the report is really we just need to understand, accept, start talking about, start passing policies in a way that stops making kids responsible for everything that made them, you know, unprepared to learn once they got in the classroom.
How do you want people to use the report? So is this something that someone should take to their local school board and say, this, look at what the Southern Education Foundation just wrote, or should they take it to their state policymaker or their state senator? Raymond, you mentioned litigation. Are there ways for this report to be used in that way?
Well, there are ways where this report can be used, unfortunately, in the arena of litigation. I say unfortunately because, you know, litigation or being in the courts, and I'm an attorney, quite frankly, that's the last place you want to be. But, you know, the sad reality is that, you know, we do find ourselves in court from time to time when the law says one thing and the practice says another. And, you know, children are being harmed. Sometimes you can't convince someone unless you go to court. So yes, this report with the detailed analysis that it provides could be of assistance there. But primarily is, as you said, one, I think people who do read the report should take it to their local school boards and inform the conversation along the lines of everything Megan's talked about, that look, you know, everything we're trying to accomplish here in terms of you know, raising education attainment levels for our students and making sure that the children in this community that are being supported by the tax dollars that pay for the school system, that they're getting the best public education they can possibly receive. And when you have deficiencies in that area, you can't just blame the school. you got to look at all the factors. And so I would hope that people take this report before the governing authorities, in this case, school boards, and say, hey, look, you know, what about these other factors? What about the employment of the parents? What about, you know, the food, you know, locations, you know, for these families? You know, what about childcare? You know, what about all these other issues that go into a healthy community which promotes a healthy school? And also, again, like you said, Chris, I hope people take this report and share it with their elected officials, you know, with their policymakers, the people who are, you know, elected and paid to address these issues. And again, not to look at it solely as what's going on in that school building, but look at what's going on around that school building that impacts the students who walk into that school every day. So it is elevating the level of the conversation beyond the simple, because these are not simple conversations. These are not simple issues. These are very times complex and multifaceted issues, issues pertaining to how to improve the education outcomes for students, particularly students, you know, who have been historically, you know, disenfranchised. And so how to take a more serious, thoughtful look at this without easy answers and come up with some thoughtful, you know, solutions that could be put in place to address some of these issues of opportunity and equity.
It would be amazing as well for anyone who works in education to pick up the report and read it and then hand it to their buddy who works in housing, or hand it to someone who, you know, works at a place that is trying to address poverty and food insecurity, or bringing it to a local leader and saying, hey, we have to invest in our communities because the school is failing, not because the school is failing, but because we haven't cared about the community. So I think also any time that this report could spark a conversation between two people who are maybe trying to work in two different, you know, issue areas, that would also be amazing, because the health sector knows something. And again, not that education people don't know this, we do, but like the health sector to some extent lives it. And I think any opportunities that, you know, we can create new conversations where people in the education sector start living it and start demanding more, you know, stop running around trying to take care of all of the world's woes and start pushing back and saying, no, you know, enough is enough. And we've got to bring other constituents, business leaders, community leaders, you know, and bring them around this table to get all of this fixed, that this is not just our job. This is not just our responsibility. So personally, that is my great wish, that people would go out and start making some good trouble based on what they learn, and realizing that there is a comprehensive message here. And that is, we have expected way too much of our schools for way too long.
Thank you, Raymond and Megan, for being on this one's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPC Tweets.